Hello, everybody. I'm Ira Melman, and this is International Edition. From Washington, we have these stories plus more. President Obama travels to Africa.
It's the first time that an American sitting head of state is visiting our country.
We'll speak live with VOA's White House correspondent. A gunman opens fire Thursday evening in a Louisiana movie theater, killing two. We'll talk with International Edition's Mohamed El-Shenawy about the Secretary of State's attempts to convince lawmakers to support the Iran nuclear agreement. And you'll hear about a program that distributes little fish made of iron to people throughout Southeast Asia. We'll tell you why. All that and more coming up right here on The Voice of America. Well, President Barack Obama arrives in Nairobi, Kenya, where he'll attend the Global Entrepreneurship Summit as he highlights growth in American economic links with sub-Saharan Africa. We'll take you to Nairobi now live, where VOA's White House correspondent Aru Pandey joins us. Aru, thanks for being with us. What's on the president's agenda?
Well, he has a very packed agenda. As you mentioned, he arrives in Nairobi late Friday. And then on Saturday, he will be speaking at the Global Entrepreneurship Summit. He'll be meeting with attendees there. And that, of course, is expected to focus on growing investment in African entrepreneurs and growing U.S. investment in Africa as a whole. The president will also be laying a wreath at the site of the U.S. embassy that was destroyed in the bombing in 1998. And from there, he'll move to the State House, where he'll hold bilateral talks with the Kenyan president, Kenyatta, and have an official state dinner there. Those talks, of course, are expected to focus on counterterrorism, how the U.S. can boost Kenya's economic, how they can bolster economic ties. And then on Sunday, President Obama will deliver a speech at a stadium and meet with young African leaders. And from there, he'll move to Ethiopia, where he'll have another packed visit, meeting with the prime minister in Ethiopia, and also doing a speech at the African Union headquarters. That will be his first visit to Ethiopia, the first visit of a U.S. sitting president to Ethiopia. And this visit to Kenya is his first as American president, though he did come here before as senator and as a private citizen before then. So a very packed few days here in Africa for the president.
For sure. Now, that visit to Ethiopia is not without controversy. He comes late in the presidency of Barack Obama. But what can you tell us more about that?
Well, the thing is, the U.S. sees Ethiopia as kind of a key ally in the region, particularly in the fight against al-Shabaab and other extremist groups. But even before this whole trip was set, many human rights groups and even top analysts out of Washington were said that this visit basically sends the wrong message. And they basically cite Ethiopia's repressive regime. Ethiopia is the fourth most censored country in the world. They say it's the second jailer of journalists on the entire continent. And they really think that this is sending the wrong message. His visit there is really sending the wrong message to the world. Now, senior U.S. administration officials have told me that basically the U.S. has regularly communicated their human rights concerns with the Ethiopian government. And this visit is a way to engage the government. I'm sure President Obama will be getting that message across in terms of the current situation, the human rights situation in Ethiopia.
Aru Pandey is VOA's White House correspondent. Aru, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
A gunman in the southern U.S. state of Louisiana opened fire Thursday evening in a movie theater, killed two people, wounded seven others before killing himself. Officials in the town of Lafayette said they know the identity of the gunman. They've only revealed that he was a 58-year-old man. Some of the victims were critically wounded. Others have non-life-threatening injuries. About 100 people were there in the theater watching the film Trainwreck when the gunman began shooting his fellow moviegoers with a handgun. Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal said the shooting was a seemingly random act of violence on families out for a night of entertainment.
As governor, as a father, and as a husband, whenever we see these or hear about these senseless acts of violence, it makes us both furious and sad at the same time.
One witness told Reuters that when the man began shooting, he wasn't saying anything. He said, "I didn't hear anybody screaming either." Another moviegoer told CNN that he thought the sound of the gunfire was part of the movie. No word on any possible motive. Turkey says it's carried out airstrikes on Islamic State targets in Syria in a significant escalation of its involvement in the battle against the extremist group. Three F-16s struck targets across the Turkish border province of Kilis, according to the Prime Minister's office. And the U.S. has been carrying out from Iraq into the U.S.-led coalition has launched thousands of bombing runs on the Islamic State positions in Syria and Iraq. Says it has some success in halting the militants' advance, but the Islamic State group still controls wide swaths of northern and western Iraq and Syria. U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter is meeting Kurdish leaders during an unannounced visit to the capital of Iraq's Kurdistan region. Carter landed early Friday in Erbil, where he is expected to confer with the president of Kurdistan, Masoud Barzani, a key ally of Washington. We have more on this throughout the day, but joining me now in studio is Andrew Palcheski with a look at what's being said today in social media. Andrew, what's going on?
Well, as you just mentioned, this shooting in Lafayette, Louisiana is one of the top trending topics, hashtag Lafayette shooting, as people are reacting. And one of the people reacting is the star of that movie Trainwreck, Amy Schumer. She's a comedian who stars in the film. She says, "My heart is broken and all my thoughts and prayers are with everyone in Louisiana." She tweeted that out from her Twitter account. It's been retweeted nearly 10,000 times since then. So more to follow on that story as information comes out. Another hashtag that's trending this morning is Kepler-452b.
Yeah.
NASA made this announcement that this Earth-like planet, calling it Earth's bigger cousin, it's about 1,400 light years away. Similar to Earth in size, not too far off in age. It says it takes about 385 days to orbit its sun, as opposed to we take 365. They're saying that this might be the start of a new discovery, maybe hoping that they'll find some other planets that are similar to Earth and maybe some intelligent life. People hopeful about that.
We say we say 1,400 light years away, which means what we're seeing happened 1,400 years ago.
Right. So now, they're in the, you know, getting close to the Renaissance.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So therefore, who knows what it's like now?
Yeah.
And conversely, if you want to dream about this, maybe if there are people on that planet, then maybe they're investigating us about what we happened here 1,400 years ago.
That is just one of the many theories. You have a lot of people coming out of the woodwork on social media, coming with their theories. And then also always we see the jokes, people saying maybe Greece can move there and take up a residence in the planet. Somebody else saying, you know, I watched all the episodes of Star Trek and they never mentioned this planet. So are we sure it's real?
Yeah, no, it can't be. Yeah.
And then finally, it is Friday. It's a, you know, try to keep things light. Hashtag Uber ice cream. Uber is the car service that you can request a car on your phone to come pick you up. They've had great success in the past where they will allow people to request kittens and puppies to play with. And now they're doing it with ice cream. They said if you call for an Uber car, they have added an option. You can have ice cream delivered to you today. Unfortunately, it's only in the United Kingdom, only in select cities, London, Manchester, Birmingham, some others. But maybe a model for other expansion that they can have some goodwill. I know they've been protest over Uber in France. Maybe everybody could use a little ice cream that would calm some nerves in France. A
little chocolate peanut butter for me, thanks.
That would be good. I'm strawberry mint chocolate chip are my favorite.
You got it. Thanks, Andrew. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Research has suggested that both the thickness and extent of Arctic summer sea ice have dramatically declined over the past 30 years. But now some British scientists say they've found the volume of Arctic sea ice has actually increased by a third after the unusually cool summer of 2013. The researchers used measurements taken by the European Space Agency's CryoSat satellite between 2010 and 2014. Researchers say that the sudden increase in sea ice volume after just one cool summer suggests that Arctic sea ice may be more resilient than has been previously believed. But a research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado, says the study's assumption on sea ice resiliency is premature since it's based on only 5 years of data and doesn't take into account all factors needed to make such a determination. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
We continue on International Edition. During Senate International Relations Committee hearings yesterday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was asked if Gulf partners like Saudi Arabia are supporting the nuclear deal with Iran. Saudi officials have neither publicly condemned or endorsed the Iran nuclear agreement, but the secretary said that his Saudi counterpart told him his country supports a peaceful resolution in the peaceful resolution to the Iranian nuclear ambition. International Edition senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke to several experts about the impact of the deal on the Middle East. Mohammed, why do U.S. regional allies, why are they fearing that the deal might end up encouraging more Iranian negative roles in the region?
Well, the Arab Gulf states in particular are concerned that Iran has been using its oil resources to fund so many proxies in the region to expand its influence and meddling in the Arab affairs. For Basma Moumani, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Waterloo in Canada, these concerns are very legitimate.
I think there is legitimate fear, particularly when we think about that the Iranian sanctions regime, once lifted, will put in the hands immediately, $100 billion in the hands of the Iranian government. And as we've seen in the case of Syria, where the Assad regime has the blood of 200,000 people on its hands, the fear is that more money will go to support proxy states like the Assad government and potentially groups like Hamas and Hezbollah. And obviously, as Yemen is embroiled in a number of conflicts, there's a fear that that would also encourage the Iranian regime to double down support for the Houthi rebels. Will it create a larger arms race in the region is another worry that, in fact, we will see is the Saudis wanting to go to the Pakistanis to get more nuclear intelligence, to create a balance of power. There are legitimate fears.
However, Moumani argues, Ira, that the Arab Gulf states should not fear that a potential warming in U.S. relations with Iran would eventually be at their expense.
Well, what about this? Another possibility, Mohammed. Could the deal pave the way for the U.S. to seek Iran's help in the fighting against the Islamic State group?
Well, experts differ in responding to that question, Ira. For example, Professor Shibli Talhami of the University of Maryland warns against playing this sectarian card and said that one reason behind the rise of the Islamic State group in Iraq was a sectarian government that favored Shiite Iraqis over its own Sunni citizens. However, Professor Moumani argues that there is already some sort of tacit cooperation with Iran on that front.
We look at what happened in Tikrit, for example. We saw General Soleiman on the ground, and the next 2 days later, aerial assaults by the Americans. The reality is there is some sort of cooperation. Maybe there's not coordination, but there's definitely already cooperation between the Americans and the Iranian government in the fight against ISIS, particularly on Iraq, maybe not so in Syria. And that's necessary. The truth is, at the end of the day, the Iraqi military is not up to snuff to do this on their own. So, you know, it is an uneasy alliance for many, but there is a common enemy of ISIS in Iraq. And undoubtedly, I think that the Iranian regime and the Americans are in some way coordinating, if not, again, necessarily cooperating.
Mohammed, thank you very much for these insights. As always, greatly appreciated.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
This is VOA. There is a program underway. It started in Asia, in Cambodia. It's called the Lucky Iron Fish. And we welcome to International Edition Alistair Summerlee from the University of Guelph in Canada. Alistair, thanks for being with us on International Edition. Tell us about the Lucky Iron Fish program.
Thanks, Ira. This is actually an idea that goes back to the 5th century BC. In China, and for a long time, people have known that if you cook in an iron pot, it can help boost the iron levels in your diet. Iron is very important. If you don't have enough, and about half the world's population these days suffers from iron deficiency, you can have a range of symptoms, anything from just feeling lethargic all the way through to serious consequences and even death. It's a problem that mostly affects women and children. Of course, over time, we've moved from cooking in iron pots to using aluminum pots. And so we don't find ways to boost the iron in our diet. Many people have to take iron supplements. They don't like them at all. So this idea came about really as a result of that history. And it is simply to put a small iron ingot, weighs about 225 grams, into a pot when you are making your soup or you're boiling rice or you're boiling your water, because you have to sterilize it to drink. In order to attract people to use it in Cambodia, where we started, we made it in the shape of a fish, and that fish is thought to be lucky in Cambodian culture. It has a 92% compliance rate, and that means that the people who are using it not only feel better, but have boosted iron levels, and they refer to it as the lucky iron fish.
Now, there has been a major change as far as iron deficiency is concerned, I guess, due to this. Is that correct in Cambodia?
There has been a change. So far, we've distributed about 50,000 of them. They actually have an impact on the communities where we are distributing them. And we've seen a 50% reduction in the amount of anemia, which is the worst form of iron deficiency.
Is the Lucky Iron Fish program limited to Cambodia?
No, we sell it on the internet at luckyironfish.com. We have chosen to use a model where if you buy a fish for yourself in North America, then we will give a fish away to a woman in need, a woman who's earning less than a dollar a day and so can't afford to buy a fish herself. We'll give one away through a hospital partnership that we have in Cambodia. And that's how we've managed to give away so many, because even though they are cheaper in Cambodia, they are still very expensive if you're living on less than a dollar a day. One of the things I should mention about the fish is, obviously because it's iron and the principle is the iron leaches off into the food, we worry that over time it might become brittle. So the fish itself has a smile on it, which in fact the women say is one of the reasons why they like it. And like all the surface features, as it's being used, the smile gradually wears away. If you use it once a day in your cooking, it will probably take 5 years for that to happen. But when the fish is no longer happy, when the smile has worn away, we say to people, bring it back. We can melt it down and make another one. And so we give them a replacement fish to make sure that they have one that isn't going to break during cooking.
Alistair Summerlee is professor at Guelph University near Toronto in Canada, and the program is called the Lucky Iron Fish. Alistair, thanks so much for being with us on The Voice of America.
Thank you very much, Ira.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. An online spat between pop superstars Taylor Swift and Nicki Minaj has come to an end. This high-profile conflict even involved other pop stars, including Katy Perry and Rihanna. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Top 5 Countdown host Ray McDonald about what happened, why it happened, and how it's come to an end.
She is considered one of the queens of pop music, but Taylor Swift was getting kind of in a bit of a tiff this week with Nicki Minaj. It all started over the Video Music Award nominations that came out earlier. Ray, what exactly, how did all of this start? How did this Twitter war start?
It all started humbly enough on July 21st when Nicki Minaj said, hey, where's my Video of the Year nomination for Anaconda? And she felt that she'd been passed over, and she made a comment that the media seemed to have double standards when it comes to females, that African Americans were held to a different standard. They were shunted aside, put on an urban award shows, and that why wasn't she in the center stage when white performers doing the same things got all the recognition. She didn't name any names.
My anaconda don't, my anaconda don't, my anaconda don't want none unless you got buns, hun.
Boy, toy named Troy used to live in Detroit. Big, big, big money, he was getting some coins. Was the shootouts with the Lord, but he lived in a palace. Boy, bought me Alexander McQueen, he was keeping me stylish.
Well, she did mention something about if you're a tall, thin, skinny woman in your video,
then, you know, you'll get attention. Now that's,
well, that caught Taylor's attention.
That's kind of a, what do they call that? It's not a direct tweet at somebody, but it's kind of an implied tweet. Because Taylor Swift and most all, well, all of the women in her Bad Blood video, which was nominated, are tall and thin and, you know, runway model types. And then, now see, I don't get what Nikki's talking about with the urban thing, though, because Beyonce was one of the other nominees.
Well, so, of course. I mean, you can pick her claims apart. And this was, I think, an emotional response. And I think you can say that certain elements of her argument have merit, and others, maybe not so much.
Well, now, see, what also goes on here is other pop stars, Katy Perry and Rihanna, weighed in or started to weigh in on this thing. It went on for a few days. And then finally, Taylor Swift called a truce. She basically said, look, I misunderstood and my bad. So sorry. Love you. You know, air kisses.
She and Nicki Minaj made up. Taylor said, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I spoke rashly, and I apologize. And Nicki said, thank you, Taylor. That means so much. My respect for you has gone up. And like you say, a peace seems to have been restored.
All right, that's VOA's Ray McDonald. You can hit him up at VOA underscore music. You can send me a tweet. I'm David underscore D Bird. That's with a Y, not an I. And you can also send your messages to VOA underscore IE. If you love like that, blood runs, cause baby, now we got bad blood. You know, it used to be bad love. So take a look what you've done. Cause baby, now we got bad blood.
This is International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington, and we invite you to follow us on Twitter. Find us at VOA underline IE. If you'd like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, just give our website at voanews.com a go. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner and scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On a recent visit to Ukraine, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs Victoria Nuland highlighted the Ukrainian people's commitment to the pursuit of a modern, democratic European state. Commending the Rada's historic votes to send constitutional amendments on decentralization to the Constitutional Court and to approve a package of reform measures required to unlock the next tranche of IMF funding, Assistant Secretary Nuland said the measures were steps that will break the old oligarchic system that operated in Ukraine and put Ukraine on the path to true democratic, open market governance, clean economy, market standards, European standards. She also noted the amendments fulfill Ukraine's obligations under the Minsk ceasefire agreements and will bring to Ukraine's constitution European standards of decentralized power, including the opportunity for all the regions of Ukraine to control their own future, to have more power in budgeting, to take the kind of responsibility for improving quality of life at the local level and the quality of democracy at the local level, and to bring growth to the local economy. A key factor in Ukraine's economic development will be confronting corruption in all its forms. Recent anti-corruption legislation allows for personnel changes in order to create a more transparent law enforcement system. Equally important is a functioning justice system. It's not just a matter of presenting cases to the prosecutor, said Assistant Secretary Nuland. The prosecutor has to complete some cases so that the people of Ukraine have confidence that if they report a crime, those people are going to pay, that there will be justice. Assistant Secretary Nuland urged unity among Ukrainians in implementing reforms. We want to see that united front work as quickly as possible on these very difficult economic and rule of law reforms. With regard to the September 2014 Minsk ceasefire agreements and the February 12th Minsk implementation plan, Assistant Secretary Nuland said, "We've made absolutely clear that we expect Minsk to be implemented. As you know, the sanctions that the U.S. and the EU have in place are there to change the policy of Russia, to encourage it to fulfill its obligations. We've made clear that they will stay in place until Minsk is fully implemented, including an end to the violence, including a return of hostages, a return of the border. But we've also made clear that if the violence increases, we're prepared to put more pressure on Russia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.